Murder at the ABA, a puzzle in 4 days and 60 scenes by Isaac Asimov. Copyright 1976 by Isaac Asimov, published by Doubleday & Company, Incorporated, Garden City, New York. This recording of the reading of Murder at the ABA was published by arrangement with Doubleday & Company, Incorporated, and was produced in 1977 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated. Murder at the ABA, a puzzle in 4 days and 60 scenes by Isaac Asimov. Note: despite my way of writing this book, all of the speaking characters in it, except myself, of course, are fictitious, and any resemblance to actual persons living or dead is purely coincidental and can only exist despite my best efforts to prevent it. In this connection, please see the note at the end of the book, but only after you've read the book. To Harlan Ellison, whose brightness of personality is exceeded only by his height of talent. Part 1. Sunday, May 25th, 1975. Scene 1. Darius Just, narrator, 1:30 p.m. Trace back the violent death of a friend and see how it happened. It wouldn't have happened if A hadn't happened first, and that wouldn't have happened if B had not taken place before it, and so on all the way back to the primordial mists of time. In the particular case in which I was involved, however, we can limit the direct causes to a specific limited series of events, all of which had to have happened for violent death to have its chance. If any one of them had not taken place, someone now dead would be alive. Or if dead, at least not then, not that way, not murder. And I was at the center of so many of those events, unwittingly, of course, but there. I trace it back to Sunday, May 25th, 1975, which was the first day of the 75th annual convention of the American Booksellers Association, ABA, at a scattering of hotels in Midtown, and to a woman whose turn it was to push her book at a press conference. She was scheduled to face the members of the press at 4 p.m., and she had to decide what to wear. There, it seems to me, as I try to reconstruct her motives in my mind, she was faced with a dilemma. On the one hand, she was young and good-looking and had a body in which all parts fell smoothly into place, so that she had the natural desire to display said body to the world. On the other hand, she was a feminist, and the book she was pushing was feminist, and there was the possibility that to use the lure of the body to promote the book would be a non-feminist thing to do. I don't know whether she hesitated at all, or if she did, how long. I don't know if she tried on different dresses or settled the matter by pure reason in her mind. The point is that she ended with a white dress which, above the waistline, was made up of generous swatches of open network, and under it she had above the waistline nothing at all but her own gorgeous self. When she remained in repose, her breasts remained safely behind the small, strategically placed opaque sections. When she raised an arm as she might, the dress hiked up on that side and one nipple went peekaboo. All this, it happens, I pieced together later. I was not there when it happened. I had nothing directly to do with it. That, too, was a link in the chain of events. When our feminist friend decided to peekaboo at the world, she put down the first flagstone of what became a pathway to death. The fact that I was not in the interview room at the time was another flagstone. Had she chosen to come down in a role of blushing modesty, none of it would have happened, perhaps, whether I was there or not. Had I been there, none of it would have happened, perhaps, even if she had come down in the nude. But she wore what she wore, and I was not there, and it all came to pass. And where was I that I was not there? I was en route. I had left at 1:30 p.m., and I was aiming for the ABA convention. My editor felt it would be a good thing for me, a writer, but not particularly a superfluously successful writer, to show up and get a little publicity and grin a little at the assembled booksellers. I had no objection to this. Everything about it would be deductible as a business expense, and it would make an excellent excuse to stay away from the typewriter for a few days. Originally, I had been aiming for Monday the 26th, which was Memorial Day, and had decided to let the first day go by. A couple of months before, I had agreed to give a morning talk, you see, at some temple on the 25th, at a site some 100 miles from the city. I saw no reason why I shouldn't let them feed me afterward. I have a long-standing love affair with lox and cream cheese on a toasted bagel, especially with a slice of Bermuda onion pushed in when no one is looking, and make a day of it. Time for the convention the next day. But then a historian friend of mine, Martin Walters, called me a week before and asked me if I could help out in a little bit of public relations at the ABA convention. He was under the impression that I was a staunch supporter of learned writings and had the even more curious notion that my name meant something to the world of scholarship and could be used to good effect. Both assumptions seemed to me to be in the highest degree wrong. But he was a friend, and you help out friends. And besides, it did not seem to me that I was required to tell him the truth, that my knowledge of history was spotty, and that the world's knowledge of my attainments was even spottier. I said, "When would you need me?" "It's scheduled for 4:20 p.m. on Sunday," he said. I did some rapid mental calculations and decided I could eat my bagels and still make it. "I'll be there," I said, adding cautiously, as I always do out of a spot of irrationality within my rational self, "barring acts of God." But the act of God had already taken place. It was another flagstone in the path. In fact, since the request for my presence came a week before our feminist friend swirled before her hotel room mirror and decided she looked too appetizing to be believed, my own statement, "I'll be there," might be looked upon as the real beginning. I gave my talk, explained politely that I would have to eat and run. I then ate at 1:30 p.m., ran for my car, and drove to the city at a moderate clip, feeling no doubt that I would make it. Nor did I have any cause to change my mind till I hit the Cross North Highway. I don't suppose anyone could call a traffic jam on the Cross North an act of God, however. The Almighty doesn't have to take any measures to ensure it. Yet I thought I had calculated it logically. It was the middle day of a 3-day weekend. Everyone who had wanted to go somewhere had already gone. Everyone who intended to come back had not yet left. I assumed I was in the eye of the hurricane, so I was perfectly at ease. The trouble is that there is no time of the day or year when one or two cars don't manage to stall themselves on the Cross North. There must be a million motorists who, when at a loss for any source of fun, decide to drive their heaps onto the Cross North and abandon them there. Once the word streaks out, telepathically I presume, that the lanes on the Cross North have narrowed, everyone north of the city funnels into them with wild cries of delight. That was the beginning of the fatal irritation that filled me that day. I'm not exactly famous for my equanimity, but there's no law that says I have to be irritated, unless you want to say there's a cosmic ukaz that states that the Cross North would irritate anybody. So I was irritated. I moved along at a slow crawl, seeing a long triple line of cars ahead of me, all moving at a slow crawl, like a heat wave with no relief in sight. I annoyed myself by wondering why I hadn't taken the Western Parkway instead, and every once in a while I threw myself into an absolute fury by glancing at my wristwatch. But I made it. I made it. I managed to get to my apartment, which is only a trifle over a mile from the hotel I was heading for, park the car, wash up a bit, change, grab a taxi, reach the hotel, make my way to the 5th floor, locate the interview room, and walk into it at exactly 4:20 p.m. Exactly 4:20 p.m.